So we find ourselves Bein Ge'ula L'Ge'ula, between the Ge'ula of Purim and the Ge'ula of Pesach. And in fact, of the four seasonal parshios, this week is also one, it's the third of the four, Parshas Parah. And the idea behind Parshas Parah, of course, is that the Jewish people, everyone needs to purify themselves to be ready to bring the Korban Pesach. And to that end, one will need the procedure of the Parah Aduma. And therefore, as a zecher for that, we read the section dealing with Parah Aduma. That's Parshas Parah. Interestingly, the Rishalmi in Maseches Megillah asks a question. One could go through the Arba Parshios numerous times and never ask this question. And that is, why is Parah before Parshas HaChodesh? We know that the order is first Shkalim, then Zachor, then Parah, and then HaChodesh. Now, Shkalim is first because that has to be before Rosh Chodesh Adar, the collection of the Machzitz HaShekel. Zachor then needs to be before Purim. But when we look at the last two, Parah and HaChodesh, actually, it would seem to be reversed. HaChodesh, which is about HaChodesh HaZalachem, about Chodesh Nisan, well, that needs to be before Chodesh Nisan. Rosh Chodesh Nisan is 2 weeks before Pesach. It doesn't take 2 weeks in order to have the Parah Aduma procedure. It takes 7 days. So actually, one could have Parshas HaChodesh first, 2 weeks before Pesach, and then Parshas Parah last, 1 week before Pesach. Why then is Parah Aduma before Parshas HaChodesh? And the answer, of course, is not that Parah Aduma is a chok and don't ask questions. The Yerushalmi actually gives a very interesting answer. And that is, we know from other experience that for everyone to, for all those that would be part of what was happening in the Beis HaMikdash on a certain moed, it was rated as taking them 2 weeks in order to get there. 2 weeks to get there, 2 weeks to get back. Where do we encounter this idea? It's for this reason that we don't ask for rain, v'sein tal umata levracha, in Eretz Yisrael until 2 weeks after Sukkot, until the 7th of Cheshvan. As the Mishnah explains, in order to give those who had been Ola Larego for Sukkot 2 weeks to get back, it's not considered kind for their trouble. They make the trip here and then we daven for them to get rained on the way back. And therefore we allow them their 2 weeks to get home and then we ask for rain. So we see that it takes 2 weeks in order to get, for everyone who needs to be here, to get to the Beis HaMikdash. And that being the case, says the Yerushalmi, that's why we read Parshas Parah before HaChodesh, because we want to read it at least 3 weeks before Pesach, to give people the 2 weeks to get here and the 7 days that it takes to undergo the Parah Aduma. So that's a very straightforward answer from the Yerushalmi for a question that is certainly needs to be asked, why Parah before HaChodesh? Just one other point that relates to Parshas Parah, and I'm not sure that it's so well known. Of the four Parshas, we know that Zachor is special. Zachor is a mitzvah from the Torah, and as you know from the reading of Zachor, it's read very slowly, it's read very carefully, it's a mitzvah from the Torah to read it. The others, as far as we are aware, not so. Shkalim is not from the Torah, and neither is HaChodesh. But the Shulchan Aruch, in two places, actually cites an opinion that Parshas Parah, is also min HaTorah. To read about the Parah Aduma, also min HaTorah. It's based on the Tosfos in Maseches Brachos. I've never heard anyone read Parshas Parah the way they read Parshas Zachor. I think no one would ever get out of shul. It's a much longer reading. But be that as it may, the Shulchan Aruch does cite the opinion that Parah is min HaTorah. And of course the question is, if you say that something is a Torah obligation, it's got to have a source in the Torah. What is the source in the Torah for reading Parshas Parah? Zachor is black on white. The Torah says Zachor. Remember. Where does the Torah tell you to read about the Parah Aduma? Ever. So here, two classic answers to this question. The first is from the Sefer Avodas Yisrael. And he says, if you pay attention to the Maftir for this week, it starts by saying Hashem spoke to Moshe and Aaron, Lemor. And then, Zoschukas HaTorah Asher Tziva Hashem, Lemor. The word Lemor features twice. Now, the word Lemor means to say. So one Lemor, I understand. Moshe is told to say to Bnei Yisrael. So when Hashem speaks to Moshe and Aaron, Lemor, it means that they should say the following to the Jewish people. But the first thing they say is their own Lemor. Part of what they're meant to say to the people is Lemor. But if Lemor means to say, then part of what they're being told to tell the people is to say. They tell the people, Lemor, speak about this. Because it's a mitzvah from the Torah to talk about the Parah Aduma at least once a year. That is a very interesting source, the two Lemors. I think we normally perhaps don't pay as much attention to Lemor. We see it as a kind of a filling word. But each time it has a meaning, and if it's twice, it means Moshe has a mitzvah to say to us, and we have a mitzvah to talk about it. That's how Parah is min HaTorah. A very different answer to how Parshas Parah could be a mitzvah from the Torah, what would its source be, comes from the Malbim. Although he doesn't talk about in his commentary Malbim on the Torah, rather in his first work, his earliest work, which I think he started, possibly even finished, I don't know, while yet in his teens, was a work called Artzos HaChayim, and it's actually a halachic work on the early simonim of Shulchan Aruch, of Aruch Chaim. And the Malbim says a very interesting thing. The Torah tells us in Parshas Ekev, Zachor, remember, Al Tishkach, don't forget, Eis Asher Hiktzafto Es Hashem Elokecha Bamidbar, that which you angered Hashem in the wilderness. For those who say the Zechiros at the end of Shacharis, it's one of the Sheish Zechiros. Remember how you angered Hashem in the wilderness. To what does this refer? Says the Malbim, the greatest thing that we did to anger Hashem in the wilderness was to build the golden calf. Which means there is a mitzvah from the Torah to remember the golden calf. And that is what we fulfill by talking about Parah Aduma. Why? Because in a respectful way, derech kavod for Bnei Yisrael, we don't read Parshas Kisisa again, which is a blow-by-blow replay of the Chet HaEgel, but we do remember it. We remember it by reading about the Parah Aduma, which as we know, and as we discussed a number of weeks ago, is seen as a kapara for the Chet HaEgel. And therefore, this is the bechavodika way of remembering the Egel, which is a mitzvah to do so from the Torah, by talking about the Parah Aduma. So these are two very interesting suggestions from the Mefarshim as to how, what the source would be for those who say that Parshas Parah, like Zachor, is min HaTorah. Okay, so having spoken a little bit about the seasonal aspect of the Shabbos, Parshas Parah, let's get down to business and talk about Bayom HaShmini. Shmini begins Bayom HaShmini on the eighth day. And it's called the eighth day because it follows what are known as the 7 days of the Miluim. The 7 days of the Miluim, we could say that they are preparatory days. And day eight is the inaugural day. The first 7 days are days of preparation. Day eight is a day of inauguration. It's the first day where the Mishkan is fully, fully running. We've mentioned in the past, and worthwhile just reminding ourselves, there's a well-known discussion amongst Rishonim, when were these 7 days? And when was the eighth day? According to Rashi, the 7 days of the Miluim were the final 7 days of Adar, which puts the Yom HaShmini of our Parsha as the first day of Nisan. While according to the Ibn Ezra, the 7 preparatory days were actually the first 7 days of Nisan, which makes the Yom HaShmini the eighth day of Nisan. There's a lot of discussion as to how to explain the relevant psukim in light of these two approaches, but either way, whatever the Yom HaShmini was calendar-wise, it was the inaugural day of the Mishkan. And as such, in addition to starting everything that will continue on an ongoing basis in the Mishkan, there were special korbanos that were brought on this Yom HaShmini. They're discussed in the opening psukim. I'm not going to look at, we're not going to take a look at all of them, but two of them particularly, one from Aaron and one from the people. And they are the egels. Obviously, they are of particular interest to us. The two egels. Let us see in Perek Tes Pasuk Beis. What are the korbanos for Aaron? Vayomer el Aaron. Moshe says to Aaron, Kach lecha egel ben bakar lechatos. You shall take a calf for a chatos, for a sin offering. So one of the korbanos that Aaron brings is a calf for a chatos. Okay. Moving on to the next pasuk, what about the Jewish people? Ve'el b'nei Yisrael tadaber lemor, and speak to the Jewish people and say to them, you shall take kechu se'ir izim lachatos, a goat for a chatos, okay, and an egel and a keves for an ola. And once again, focusing on the egel in the equation both times, we see that for the Jewish people, the egel that they bring is an ola, a burnt offering. And putting it together so far, what we see is that for Aaron, his egel is a chatos, and for the Jewish people, their egel, their calf, is an ola. And the question, of course, is why? However the egel is meant to be addressed here, why is it addressed to a different type of korban on Aaron's part than on the part of the Jewish people? Mefarshim explain. Clearly, the presence of an egel as a korban, a calf as a korban on this eighth day, the inauguration of the Mishkan, is coming to address the issue of the chet ha'egel, of the calf that the Jewish people made. The Mishkan, as we've seen, it's Mishkan ha'edos, it's the testimony that we're forgiven fundamentally for the chet ha'egel, which means if you see an egel brought as a korban on this day, it's clearly addressing the chet ha'egel. Aaron's relationship with the chet ha'egel is very different than that of the Jewish people, but they both have a relationship. A chatos, we know from halacha, always comes to atone for an action. When we speak, sometimes even an unintentional action, like on Shabbos or whatever it is, when a person brings a chatos, it's for something that they did. And here too, as difficult as it is to say, it's unavoidable. It's black and white in the verses. Aharon needs to bring a chatos for an egel. Why? Because he did something. What he did is he made the egel. The psukim tell us in Parshas Kisisa, it was Aharon who made the egel. And in order to address that action, he needs to bring an egel as a chatos offering. Now, as we can appreciate, we're in a very complex situation. Aaron's role is and his relationship with the chet ha'egel is very complicated. Because as true as it is that physically he made the egel, nevertheless, we know that he is only doing so in order to bring things to a good outcome. He's dragging his feet. He's trying to take as long as possible so that Moshe should come back. He tells them to cut that it should happen tomorrow, because hopefully Moshe will come back in the interim. If he doesn't do this, it will happen quickly. If he doesn't do the egel slowly, it will happen quickly. And that's aside from what Rashi tells us, that Aaron saw that Hur protested and he was killed. If he feels that if they kill him, there'll be no kapara for the Jewish people. And therefore, these are the calculations, these are the considerations that go behind Aaron's involvement in the egel. We could call it L'Shem Shamayim. It was L'Shem Shamayim. And still we see that Aaron needs kapara. He needs atonement for that act, which is very difficult. After all, should he not have done it? As we've discussed, if he doesn't do it, it will only be worse. And still, he needs kapara. An act is an act. Later on in Parshas Ekev, interestingly, it's not discussed in these parshas, but in Chumash Devarim, far and away, Moshe will say that Hashem was angry at the Jewish people. His anger flared at Aaron for his involvement in the Egel. Once again, we ask, what should he have done? Should he not have done it? And set against all of this, we need to contend with the fact that as a result of the Chet HaEgel, the priesthood, the Avodah, was moved from the Jewish people generally, who forfeited it, and given to the Kohanim, and none more than Aaron. Aaron is the Kohen Gadol, which means Hashem is angry at him for making the Egel, and at the same time he's rewarded by being the Kohen Gadol as a result of the Egel. And when you put all of this together, you realize that you're in a complicated situation. But to whatever degree Aaron needs to address the issue, his involvement with the Egel was purely in the realm of action, of what he did, and that's why his Egel is a chatos, a sin offering. But now we ask, what about the Jewish people? Their Egel is an Ola, is a burnt offering. But what exactly are they coming to do with this Ola, this burnt offering? And more specifically, we ask, it was only a minority of the Jewish people who actually worshipped the Egel. And moreover, all those who did have been dealt with. They've either been executed or they were killed in a plague or whatever happened. As far as we know, there's no one left among the Jewish people who actually was involved in worshipping the Egel. So if that's true, what does everyone else need to do? They didn't do anything. Why should they need to bring a korban? They didn't do anything. Says Rav Zalman Sorotskin in the Sefer Aznayim LaTorah, it's true. The rest of the people didn't do anything. And that's why they need a kapara. Because with a minority of people who are involved in the Egel, the majority should have done something. It shouldn't have been just one person called Hur who stood up. It should have been the entire people that protested. Sometimes doing nothing is not acceptable if a protest will make a difference. And so often it does. What does this have to do with us? Rashi informs us in the beginning of Chumash Vayikra, just 2 weeks ago. What does an Ola come for? An Ola doesn't come to atone for a wrongdoing that a person did. It comes to atone for a mitzvah that a person neglected to do. Al bitul aseh. An Ola comes to atone for a mitzvah one neglected to do. And that's why the Jewish people need to bring an Ola, because they neglected to do a mitzvah at the time of the Egel, and that is the mitzvah of administering rebuke, of protesting, of stating that what was happening was not correct. Because if they do nothing, then not only do they allow it to happen, but there's a certain climate which then makes it acceptable. And that is what happens when people who could have done something do nothing. And therefore, says the Aznayim LaTorah, we understand why each one brought an Egel for the reason that they did. Aaron brings an Egel as a chatas for the action of making the Egel. The surviving Jewish people bring an Egel as an Ola for the inaction of not protesting. Chatas is for action, Ola for inaction. Absolutely. And I think there's room to add something here. It's a bit of a sensitive idea. If it's incorrect, I'm retracting it in advance. But I don't think it's incorrect. The Gemara tells us that the punishment throughout the generations, every generation receives some measure of punishment for the Chet HaEgel. As Hashem himself says, Uvayom Pokdi, when I visit them for doing some other wrongdoing, ufakadati aleim avonam, I will also visit them for this wrongdoing. And the Gemara says every generation receives something like that. It means the Jewish people are never punished outright in subsequent generations for doing the egel. But if they're punished for something else, it continues a little bit longer as punishment for the egel. And it's an interesting type of punishment. I'm not exactly sure what's considered to be normal for punishment for this type of this. But it's never an overt punishment. It's always coming on the back of something else. They do something else wrong, and it lingers a little bit. It doesn't go away as quickly as they'd like it to, and that's because of the egel. And perhaps one may suggest that this really is measure for measure. This is like for like. Because if the Jewish people's wrongdoing at the time of the egel was one of passivity, then their punishment comes in a passive form. In other words, they finished being punished for whatever it was that they did, and now Hashem should actively remove it, but he doesn't. He remains passive just for a little bit longer, and that's how they get the retribution for the Chet HaEgel, because that was their wrongdoing, is that they should have done something, and they didn't step forward. So Hashem doesn't step forward as quickly as we'd like him to. I think this understanding of the Chet HaEgel is very meaningful for us, because it takes the Chet HaEgel out of history 3,000 years ago, or 3,000 plus years ago, and it makes it very relevant to us. If the moral of the story of the Chet HaEgel is, when you're stuck in the desert, don't make a golden calf, so I think that's rather easy to abide by. We don't have many issues. But if the moral of the story is, when you see something wrong and you can make a difference and protest, be sure to do so, well, that's already something that has meaningful and broad application in many, many other settings. That's a living lesson from the Chet HaEgel. And so these are, I think, important insights for the special korbanos of the Yom HaShmini. As we know, the Yom HaShmini, the eighth day, was marred by tragedy in the death of Nadav and Avihu. And what's fascinating about this whole episode with Nadav and Avihu is that there are almost like an unending list of reasons why they deserve to be killed, which are provided by the Gemara and the Medrash, even though there seems to be a reason given by the Pasuk itself. It says they brought Esh Zara, a foreign fire, that Hashem did not command, whatever that means. And with all this, there are numerous other reasons that are given. They wanted to be the leaders, and they brought the Ketores where they shouldn't have gone at a time where it wasn't appropriate. One of the most fascinating reasons for the death of Nadav and Avihu, and Nadav and Avihu, by the way, are also complicated people, because we're not even able to look at them as bad people, because Moshe's response to this is to say, Hashem says, I'll be sanctified by those who are close to me. So now we know that Nadav and Avihu are close to Hashem. So they themselves are very complicated. Says the Medrash, the reason why Nadav and Avihu died, or deserving to die, is because they didn't have children. Ad kan the Medrash. Now, among the dozen or so other reasons that are given by Chazal, this one seems to be the most inscrutable. Because, after all, as important as it is to get married and have children, etc. and so forth, how does this hold a candle to all the other reasons that are given? And what's it got to do with what they're doing here? It doesn't seem to be in the same category of wrongdoing. And all of a sudden, the Medrash says, you know where they died? They never had children. A fascinating explanation of this Medrash is found in the Sefer Pardes Yosef, from Yosef Potsanovsky, one of the greats of pre-war Europe. And he explains, when the Medrash says that the reason Nadav and Avihu died is because they didn't have children, it doesn't mean to say as a punishment for the sin of not getting married and having children, this was their punishment that they died. It doesn't mean that. Their sin was something else. Their sin was that they could not fathom that it would not be a positive thing to get as close as they could to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And if the closest is in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, that's the place to be. And even if Hashem hasn't asked for it, it's still good. In other words, they were given boundaries, and they couldn't understand that how those boundaries could be positive. Because as far as they're concerned, life is about getting close to Hashem. And the closer you get, the better. And when they were told, but that's too close, they couldn't accept it. It didn't make sense to them. And therefore they crossed those boundaries. Says the Medrash, you know why? Because they didn't have children. What does that mean? Because that's how children act. Anyone who's raised children knows that from their point of view, from their perspective, they have a very clear and firm sense of good, what's good for them, what's bad for them, and they can never understand how even more of a good thing could be a bad thing. And if for them, sweet things are good, so then an infinite number of sweet things must be infinite goodness, and they don't understand how that can lead to a damaging situation. If Nadav and Avihu had children, they would have known, they would have encountered firsthand how you can have two perspectives on what is considered good and how important boundaries are. They would have been on the giving side of those boundaries, and they would have had this experience whereby, as much as the child thinks that it knows what's good for it, the parent knows better. Says Pardes Yosef, the gulf between our intellect and Hashem's infinite wisdom is much greater than the gulf between a parent and a child. And therefore Nadav and Avihu would have then had the insight to realize that perhaps what I think is good for me in abundant measure is perhaps damaging for me. They would have had, they'd been able to relate to that idea. But because they never had children, they were never able to experience the notion that they might not know what's best for them. And therefore they crossed the boundaries in the ways that the other Midrashim explained, and they met their end in that way. Very, very interesting and thought-provoking explanation of that Medrash on this episode of Nadav and Avihu. Let's proceed and turn our attention now to a central part of the Parsha, which is those species which are permitted to eat, not permitted to eat, what's known as tahor and tame, pure and impure, although it doesn't mean pure and impure in the way that we normally talk about tumah and tahara. It means permitted and prohibited. And these are to be found in Perek Yud Aleph. And as we know, the Chumash begins with the kosher species of animals, and there are two signs that it needs in order to be kosher. It needs to have split hooves and to chew the cud. Well, do those two always go together? Does every animal have either both or neither? We know that there are certain that have one of those two characteristics. And they are mentioned in Perek Yud Aleph, Pasuk Dalad to Zion. There are four of them in total. They are, Pasuk Dalad talks about the camel, Es HaGamal, it chews the cud, but it doesn't have split hooves. Second is the Shafan. Third is the Arneves. I'm leaving them untranslated because that's a whole big discussion as to what is the Shafan, what's the Arneves. We assume that the Arneves is the hare. What's the Shafan? Is it a hyrax? Is it all these sorts of species? That's a discussion. Either way. And finally, the Chazir, the pig, also has only one kosher sign. It has split hooves, but doesn't chew the cud. All of these are treif, what we would call treif. Once again, that's a misnomer. When the halacha talks about treifa, it refers to an animal that has a life-threatening defect. Even a kosher animal, that's called treifa. So we borrow that. We would use the term chazer treif, even though the chazer might not be a treifa. But that's a question of parlance. So these four animals, it's both or nothing. You need both signs, or to put it slightly differently, the pasuk here is telling us that there's no such thing as a half kosher lunch. It's got to have both simanim, and that's there. There is a fascinating medrash Vayikra Rabba, which talks about these four animals or beasts, because it relates them to what we know as the four exiles that the Jewish people are destined to undergo. They are, of course, Bavel, Babylon, secondly Persia, which is the story of Purim that we just came out of, third is Greece, which is the Hanukkah story, and the fourth is Rome, where we are still currently in that exile. Some say it could morph a little bit into Golus Yishmael, but either way, certainly the trunk is that of Rome. And the Medrash proceeds to draw parallels between these four animals and these four exiles. And it takes them, Al-Rishon Rishon, the first animal, the camel, that's the Babylonian exile, and then the Shafan, the Hyrax, that's the Persian exile, and then the hare is the Greek exile, and then finally the pig is the Roman exile. Of course, we're slightly mystified by this association of the Medrash. After all, not every time there are four things in the Torah do they instantly relate to the four exiles. So thus we are moved to ask, Ma'inyan animals, Eitzel, exile. How do these four animals somehow line up with the exiles? There's a very well-known Gemara. It's in Maseches Yuma, on Daf Tes Amud Beis. Well, I'll start perhaps with a line which is not so well known. It's equally enigmatic. The Gemara is seeking to compare two generations: the generation of the destruction of the first Beis Hamikdash, and the generation of the destruction of the second Beis Hamikdash. The first are called Rishonim, the earlier ones, the destruction leading up to the first Beis Hamikdash. And the second are called Acharonim. And the Gemara proceeds to compare and contrast them. And it has the following analysis. It states, if you want to know which was better, the earlier ones at the first Beis HaMikdash destruction or the later ones, the second Beis HaMikdash, you should know. Tovot Siparnon Shel Rishonim. Mikresam Shelacharonim. Better the nails, the fingernails of the first ones were better than the stomach of the second one. Tzipornayim, fingernails. Keres, stomach. And that's the Gemara's analysis. That's the Gemara's contrast and comparison. I think it's quite an unusual way of portraying or depicting the first ones and the second ones. I've never heard anyone come off looking good if you say that their nails are better than the other one's stomach. I mean, they're not even equivalent to each other. How is this in any way an assessment of anything? The Vilna Gaon explains, and this brings us to the portion in that Gemara which is well known. Namely, it describes the sins that led to the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash and the second Beis HaMikdash. That which led to the first Beis HaMikdash are the three well-known Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayos, and Shvichus Damim, what's known as the three cardinal sins. That's the first Beis HaMikdash. What about the second Beis HaMikdash? Sinas Chinam, baseless hatred. To teach you, says the Gemara, that Sinas Chinam is equal to those three averos, which is quite a statement to make. As much as we're familiar with it, it doesn't make it any less challenging. How is sinas chinam equal to these other three averos? At any rate, what we do see is that leading up to the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, there were terrible sins. It almost boggles the mind how they were so rampant and rife. Yet one thing is true at the same time. All these sins were readily apparent, easily identifiable. You cannot hide them. You cannot hide these sins, their actions. The fourth Sinas chinam is easier to hide. It resides inside the person. It doesn't always, it's not always detectable. And therein lies the difference between them. Because as terrible as a sin is, if it's identifiable, if you can identify it, you can rectify it. But the danger begins when something is so nefarious in that it cannot be detected. If it can't be detected, it might go unchecked indefinitely. It might never be rectified because it's never identified. And in fact, the Gemara itself says it's for this reason that the first exile had a finite duration, a fixed duration, and it was revealed to them. They knew from the outset that their first exile would be 70 years. The Navi Yirmiyahu tells them. What about the second exile? Don't know. We're not told. Why? Says the Gemara, Rishonim, Shenisgala Avona. Since with the first ones their sin was revealed, Nisgala Kitsum, the end of the exile was revealed. And again, the understanding is as per the above. If the sin is revealed, it's a terrible thing, but you can see it and you can deal with it and you can already begin to count towards its rectification. But acharonim shalonis gala avonam, if the sin is not revealed, shalonis gala kitsam, you can't talk about when the end will be, you don't even know when the sin will be identified. Or to put it slightly differently, says the Vilna Gaon, look at the early sins. The problem is all on the outside. Readily visible. But with the second Beis HaMikdash, the problem is on the inside. And now we can begin to see the parallel between these four animals that have one kosher siman and these four exiles. Because the first three of those animals, their kosher siman is on the inside. They chew the cud after whatever fashion they do. They don't have both kosher signs, but the non-kosher sign is on the outside, much like the Jewish people themselves. Their trephus is in their nails. It's in their hooves. It's in their claws. While for the second, leading up to the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, their hooves are shiny, squeaky clean, couldn't be more kosher. But their non-kosher is on the inside. And now the question is, it's hard to say which is better, because neither of them are good. But one has to ask, which is worse? And we've already seen, one shouldn't be treif not on the inside, not on the outside, but there's one mila. If the treif is on the outside, you can see it and deal with it. And that, says the Vilna Gaon, is what the Gemara means when it says, Tovat Sipornim shall Rishonim, the nails of the earlier ones were better mikreisam shelachronim than the stomach of the later ones. It's a way of depicting the difference between these two generations. The first generation, their trephus was in their nails, they're kosher on the inside. And that itself requires some understanding. How can you talk about a generation who are involved in bloodshed, adultery, and idolatry and say they're kosher on the inside? It sounds like their problems are purely behavioral. And still the Gemara says it. Whereas the others, their trephus was in their stomach. It's the inner sign that's no good. And the Gemara says, better the nails of the first, where the trephus you could see it, than the stomach of the second. And this leads us to, and we are still in the exile precipitated by the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash. And it's the exile of Rome. And that corresponds to the fourth of these animals, the pig, kosher on the outside, not kosher on the inside. The patron of the Roman exile is Esav himself. Esav is Edom, Edom becomes Rome. And Esav himself is likened to a pig, as we know from Rashi and Parshas Toldos, because he looks for the most external points of similarity between him and his father. How do we see this? He gets married when he's 40 years old. And the pasuk makes a point of telling us. I think there's actually only two people in the Chumash that were told how old they were when they got married. And they are Yitzhak and Esav. How old is Yitzhak? 40. How old is Esav? 40. And what's the point? The point is, here is Esav making a show of the similarity between him and Yitzhak. As if to say, the Masorah continues, chip off the old block, like father, like son, he was 40, I was 40, we're practically indistinguishable one from the other. Whereas, of course, this is only in one of the most external of ways. Beyond that, they have nothing in common with each other. And Rashi says, it's like the pig. When he crouches down, he sticks his hooves out. That's what Esav is doing. Right? Everything about him is treif, except for his hooves. He sticks them out and makes sure that everyone can see them. And as a hiddur mitzvah, the more people that trip over them, the better, because they cannot fail to notice his shiny hooves. And therefore, the exile of Rome begins with Esav. And I think it's fair to say that the longer it goes on, the more it partakes of that quality of emphasizing appearances, of emphasizing external points of similarity. And it affects the Jewish people. The Jewish people are affected by the exile in which they live. Even if they do Jewish things, the Jewish things that they do are affected by the galus in which they are. The Gemara informs us that one of the rabbis of the Talmud, after his Shmona Esrei, he would offer the following short prayer. He would say, Master of the world, you know deep down we want to do what you want to do. But certain things get in the way. And one of them is called Shibud Malchios. Shibud Malchios means subjugation of the kingdoms. Shibud Mishubadim Hayinu Lepar B'Mitzrayim. Shibud Malchios. That stops us from doing what we'd really like to do, which is your will. And the question is, what exactly does Shibud Malchios mean? This is, by the way, from the Gemara in Maseches Brachos and Daf Yud Zayin. Two things stop us from doing what we'd like to do. One is called Seor Shebe'isa, yeast in the dough, just leading up to Pesach. Yeast in the dough is the Yetzirah, that's a problem from within. The Yetzirah is like yeast in the dough. Yeast basically inflates the dough and makes it look like much more than it is. And that's what the Yetzirah does to a person. Using only air, hot air, typically. And the second thing is Shibud Malchus. Subjugation of the kingdoms. And what does that mean? So on a simple level, of course, it refers to the times when the exiling nation forbade the fulfillment of mitzvahs, declared them illegal and punishable and so on and so forth. It for sure means that. But it means much more than that. It's not just that the controlling nation does not allow us to do mitzvahs. It's more than that. The concept of a shibud. Shibud means to have a hold on something, to have control of something. The idea of Shibud Malchus means if you live in a certain place, it has a hold on you. It has an effect on you in ways you might not ever even think to question, because it's just part of the fabric of the air that you breathe. It's in every turn. It's in every place. You grew up with it. It's in the air. And that's why people who grow up in certain countries have the mannerism of those countries. They don't learn them formally, they absorb them. Shibud Malchus means the Malchus, it just by containing you, it has a hold on you. It affects the way you look at things, it affects the way you define things. And when it comes to Rome, what that means is, if the Roman exile is typified and characterized by an emphasis, if not an obsession, on appearances, just like the original Esav, that can affect the way that we even do the things that we do. When in Rome, do as the Romans do, even if you're not doing the things that the Romans are doing. You're doing other things, but you're still doing them the way that the Romans do their things. And that's what makes it so difficult. Because if they emphasize appearances in terms of profession or prestige or whatever, there is that hold on us that also emphasizes appearances. And of course, not to be misunderstood, one should appear kosher, but one should appear kosher as a reflection of how one is or how one is aspiring to be, not as a substitution for how one doesn't care to be anymore. And if this was always symptomatic of the exile of Rome, I think never more so than in our time. It's never been easier for a person to portray themselves in a certain way, and there's never been more emphasis. And everyone wants to show how they look about whatever they're doing. Very easy for the inner questions never to be asked, which is how kosher are things actually, and not just how kosher do they look. So of course, the moral of the story is we do want to look kosher. We want to look kosher because we want to be doing the right thing. But if we can spare an inner moment to be doing the right thing because it's the right thing, and not just to be seen as doing the right thing, then we have surely struck a decisive blow and taken a decisive step away from the hold of the Roman exile and a step out of the Roman exile. So these, again, are messages from the kosher and non-kosher food. Of course, practically, it's about where you shop and what brands you buy. But in the more inner sense, it's about the way that you do everything that you do. These are the Vilna Gaon's lessons from these four beasts, the beasts of exile, ultimately, and our wars against the Chazir, and salvation, or the redemption, more correctly, starts from within. That's really what the Vilna Gaon is saying. We just move for the final few moments to a pasuk at the end of the parsha, Perek Yud Aleph Pasuk Mem Dalet. The parsha, so to speak, is winding down, but the mafarshim haven't finished yet. Pasuk Mem Dalet, Ki Ani Hashem Elokechem, I am Hashem, your God, v'hiskadishtem v'yisim kadoshim. You shall sanctify yourselves, and you shall be holy. Now, it's hard to know what to do with a pasuk like that, because we're familiar with kadoshim tihiyu, whatever holiness means. And here you have a double-barreled expression. Sanctify yourselves and make yourselves holy. It sounds very general in nature. And yet the Gemara attaches two specific practices to this pasuk. And they are washing hands before a meal and at the end of a meal. Says the Gemara in Maseches Brachos Daf Nun Gimel, what's the first phrase? V'hiskadishtem, sanctify yourselves. Elu mayim rishonim. That's mayim rishonim. Negel vasser, netilas yadayim, at the beginning of the meal. V'yisem kedoshim, and you shall be holy. Elu mayim acharonim. That's the washing at the end of the meal. So those are two very specific practices. Of course, the pasuk is what we would call an asmachta. It's not a drasha in the sense that it gives us Torah law. Washing hands before and after are not Torah law, they're bidrabanan. So if the pasuk is adduced, it has a certain basis, but it's not, it's what's called an asmachta, it's a link, not an actual drasha, but either way. And this is, of course, a classic thing that if you ever, something sounds too general and you're not sure exactly what it means, look in the Gemara and you'll find exactly what it means. How do I sanctify myself? How do I make myself holy? Says the Gemara, it's very simple. Wash, netilas yadayim, and mayim achron. The problem is, this is not the only place in Shas where Mayim Achronim is discussed. I think much better known source for the discussion of Mayim Achronim is the issue of Melach Sodomis, of that very, very toxic salt from the region of Sodom that people used to have on the table because it really gave a kick to whatever they were eating. But it's dangerous, says the Gemara. It can blind you. And so, as much as you may want to have it as part of your meal, but you for sure want to wash your hands at the end of the meal. Mayim Achronim is an issue of Melach Sodomis. That salt of Sodom, it can blind the eyes. And for this reason, as we know, there are many authorities who say that Mayim Achronim is not an obligation anymore because we don't have that salt. Others say it still is, and that's part of the different minhagim, different customs about Mayim Achronim. But of course, one cannot help but notice just how different these two explanations are from each other. One, if you look in the Gemara in Brachas, it says, what's Mayim Achronim all about? Being holy, Visim Kadoshim. It's about holiness. If you look in the other Gemara, it's about avoiding the blinding effects of the salt of Sodom. I mean, these two explanations couldn't be more different from each other. So it seems like your perspective on the whole question of Mayim Achronim will be a function of, I guess, at what stage you join the Daf Yomi program. Because if it was before the correct part of Brachas, it's going to be about holiness. But if you miss that part and you catch it at Chulin, it's going to be about protecting your eyes. What's it all about? Says Rav Kook, Zatzal. These two Gemaras are talking about the same thing. How so? What do we know about the people of Sodom? They declared it the worst offense to house guests. No stranger who could potentially be taking something from them was allowed into their city. Why? Because they were so protective of their assets. It was such a fertile place, as was discussed, as described when Lot went there. Lot went there back in the day before it was destroyed. And it's described in the most verdant and fertile terms. So it was the best place. And because they became so fixated with their assets, protecting them. So then they started to protect them against others, and one thing led to another until it was constitutionally prohibited to allow anyone else to come in. That's how the constitution of Sodom was born, says the Medrash. Says Rav Kook, everyone needs a bit of salt in life. How do we know this? Because look at the most austere of diets, as prescribed in Pirkei Avos, Kachi Darka Shel Torah. We say towards the end, Perek Vav, this is the way of Torah. Pas b'melach tochal u'mayim b'masur tishta. Bread with salt and some water. That means if all you're having is bread and water, you still have a bit of salt. Everyone needs a bit of tam in life. Everyone needs to enjoy life. And that's represented, that taste is represented by salt. It's a good thing. It keeps you going. It keeps you in good spirits. And it keeps you functioning optimally and at most, you're most productive. Everyone needs a bit of salt in life. But it can get out of hand. Because as important as it is to enjoy life as part of living as a productive person, if enjoying life becomes the goal, or to put it in the Gemara's terms, if your salt is the salt of Sodom, it can blind the eyes. At that point, you cannot see anyone else. Because there's no room for anyone else. Because they're potentially taking something from you. And what is life about if not protecting everything that you have? That's all that life is about. And that's where the Gemara says, Melach Sodom is the salt of Sodom. If enjoying life becomes your fixation, it blinds your eyes. There's no kindness extended to someone else from something that's mine. The highest value is protecting that which is mine. And that's called Sodom. Mesame Sinai. Well, what's the antidote to that? What's the refua for that? What's the solution? The solution, says Rav Kook, is the other Gemara. V'hiskadishtem v'yisem kadoshim. Sanctify yourselves. Make yourselves holy. Elevate yourselves. Have a higher vision of life. Have a more profound understanding of what your goals should be and how to view your assets within those goals. Because if you live a holy life, if you live a life of values and of meaningful goals, then all of your assets are part of that, but you understand that they're also there as part of your goals, and part of your goals is to share them with those who are less fortunate than you. The antidote for the blindness of the eyes that comes from the salt of Sodom is v'yisem kadoshim, to have an elevated perspective on life. And then all of your assets will find the right place. And we know it to be true. We know that it's as strange as it sounds. Some people, they have everything and they can give nothing. And other people have nothing and half of it's yours. And if I may conclude, and I was not planning on speaking about this, but of course it's very difficult not to mention it at all, and only in the best of ways. We don't. The purpose of the shir is to learn the parsha. But I think if one could say about Rav Kanievsky, as Zatzal, who passed away just a few days ago, he is an embodiment of what Rav Kook was an embodiment of what Rav Kook was talking about. I don't know anyone else who had so many Jewish people walking, traipsing through his home every day for hours. It's true, you could only get a minute or two with him, or perhaps even less, because there were hundreds of people behind you. And the door was never closed. Or the hours were beyond any range of normalcy. And it's not that he didn't have what to do. He's learning as much as he can, whenever he can. But his door is open. But why is his door open? There's nothing in there except for him, his words of wisdom, blessing, encouragement. A person lives a life of Kedusha, so then his eyes are open. And his eyes are open for the needs of others. And Kol Dichvin Yesev Yechol, anyone who wants can take the trip to his house and come in and speak to him. You don't need an invitation. And the stream of people were endless. So of course we're dealing with levels that are light years from where we are. To think of other people who are even close to that age, whose house is open in that way. But it's because it's a life of Kedusha, the eyes are open. And that, I think, is certainly a note well worth pondering, a good note with which to conclude the shiur. So we should all have a good evening, a wonderful week, and we should all hear Besoros Tovos. All the very best.